You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards. Today I sit down with Waco Lin, author of the fantastic new book, Crazy Screenwriting Secrets, How to Capture a Global Audience. The book does a great job delving into structure, character, and genre, but Waco also has a vast amount of experience working in the Chinese film market, now the largest film market in the world. If you, like me, want to write movies for China, you can't simply take an existing script and move the location from, say, Chicago to Beijing. And Waco explains why. Also, I was shocked to learn that China doesn't make movies about ghosts or supernatural events. To find out why, take a listen. All right, so Waco, you have this great new book. It's
yes.
called Crazy Screenwriting Secrets, How to Capture a Global Audience.
Yes.
You are a professional screenwriter.
Yeah.
You've worked in both Hollywood, right, and
yeah.
China.
Right.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about why you wanted to write this amazing book.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, here's the thing. I think everyone, there's so many screenwriting books out there, right? And I think screenwriting pretty much talks about the similar things all the time. And because lately, the last few years, I've been focusing on the U.S. and China co-production. And I think, obviously, there's been a lot of great efforts trying to make that happen, but it still has a lot of, like, challenging and learning curves because it only makes sense, right? The two of the world's biggest market want to work together. So I just thought... And from my experiences working in China and working here, it's always all been a lot of just like me explaining what, you know, craft structure and stuff, you know, of the quote unquote the U.S. way, which is the Hollywood way, which is really the global way, you know, of stuff. It's not necessarily the right structure. It's just a structure that the world is used to, right? Because most people consume American films just because our industry has been going for long and long. So going back to the question why I said write this book, so I just thought, it'd be really cool to do, you know, half the book to do, like, you know, how-to kind of a screenplay. But really, the second half is to explain how the Hollywood system works, which is evolving, ever-evolving, and covering China as well. So the idea is, I think, we need to go back to the basics. So if we're going to have a global, which is that's where everything's going towards, right, from Netflix, Warner Media, all different streaming, you know, everyone's going digital, and streaming means global. So I just thought we're going to be more about global storytelling, about it's not just like Americana kind of telling story that's set from Americana perspective that goes to the world. It's really about a global perspective. So I just thought it'd be really great to cover screenwriting in that way. So it's not so just like heavy on the American kind of way, but really the global way and how we consume stories. And so the first half is thought, well, you know, I'm not sure if you had Lou Hunter back at UCLA.
I knew Lou, yeah.
You knew Lou, right. So, and I just thought, you know, always been a struggle, isn't it? Like you come up with an idea for a pitch, you want to write a screenplay, but you always feel like it's always been done somewhere, right? Now that seems so derivative, it's that. And I remember Lou just said this great thing, well, it hasn't been done by you. So I thought, okay, well, screenwriting book is done by me, so what's a different angle that I can do? I love food, and I'm Taiwanese, Chinese, so a big part of our culture is food. You know, instead of saying hello, we say, have you eaten? That's how we say it. That's how we greet each other. So I just thought, how cool it'd be to kind of approach screenwriting from a culinary way. And I feel, you know, obviously, food is a common access point, I feel, for any culture. Isn't it, right? And families, we all sit down and we eat and we communally share story. I thought, oh, that's a good kind of, you know, universal way of entering, and it's something I'm passionate about. So that's why I wrote the book.
That's great. And I do have to say I enjoyed the food analogy.
Oh, okay, thank you.
So it was fun to kind of digest.
Right, no pun intended, right?
Right.
Pun intended.
Pun intended. The screenwriting structure through a three-course meal, and
yeah.
I thought it was very clever. And I should also tell my listeners that both of us went to the UCLA
yes.
MFA program.
Yes.
Studied screenwriting, and Lou Hunter is a professor there,
yeah.
in case you were wondering. So I want to ask you a few craft questions.
Sure.
One thing that you talk about when you're creating a protagonist mm-hmm. is giving the protagonist flaws.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you mean by a flaw and why that's important.
Yeah, I just think flaws, well, it's important. And that's one of the distinct differences, and I would want to say of all the it's a balance of flaw and something sympathetic, right? You know, the classic Save the Cat, right? That book. So that's a sympathetic part. And a flaw, just it's to enhance that human flaw. And I think a lot of times we start writing a screenplay, we don't really, we're kind of writing kind of the better version of ourselves, if you will. So, and I think in other countries, in other non-Hollywood, when in crafting a story, we don't tend to really want to infuse flaw because we don't want to write kind of things. But I think it's really enhancing it. And I think what makes Hollywood films, global films, really fascinating that reach the global audience, that we see the change, we see the arc. That's what makes it interesting, right? Because they represent the engine of the movie, but we see how there's a transition. So like, oh, that was a worthwhile journey, right, to redeem that flaw. And I know it's very, it sounds cliche, but again, cliches are cliches because they work. So always I look at a piece and I look at what is the flaw and how you derive, how do you come up with the flaw? What's the character flaw? Is it just go back to your own flaws, infuse into that character? I think for every story I do, when I start with a character, even if I'm just carving that character's life at age 40, I will go back from the very beginning. Even though the 40 years will never see that, or never hear anything about that character, the origin story is very important, whether it ever appears or ever, because that's a motivation for that character. And I feel, obviously, when we're kids, or we're babies and infants, we're flawed, aren't we? I mean, we're crazy. That's where crazy comes from, right? Fearless is basically, we'll do stuff. You don't worry about hurting other people's feelings. You're very direct. You say things in your face. So kind of how do you tap into that flaw? I'd go back to childhood. I'd go back to observing the crazy kids, nephews and nieces. I think back when they're toddlers driving me crazy, and so that's their flaws. And I put that, and how do I infuse that into adulthood? So you go to that man-child, right? And the whole, you know, that Adam Sandler made a career out of that, really. You know, but obviously transition, you know, going to different genres and whatnot is tapping to that flaw that we see as flaw as adults, if you will, right? You know, sure. Something said, so I think, really, children, babies, infant, toddlers, they're really they're, to me, they're what movie characters are, except you put them in adult form, if you will.
Yeah, it's interesting. I recently spoke to the writer James Vanderbilt.
Oh, amazing.
He did a murder mystery for Netflix.
Yeah.
And Adam Sandler plays.
I enjoyed that. I saw that, actually.
It was really cute.
I loved it, yeah.
And he plays a very flawed policeman. He can't shoot straight. He can't pass his detective's test.
Yes.
And those are great flaws. But it took about 13 years to get that movie made.
Interesting.
And yeah. James thinks it might be because a lot of comedic actors don't want to come off as so flawed. But where someone as... someone like Adam Sandler, like, loved it. Mm-hmm. He's like, this is great. I'm going to go for it. Because he understands comedy.
Yeah.
He truly understands the man-child
yes.
thing that you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great backstory. I didn't know about that. See, like, we're learning things from this podcast. Amazing.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, I feel like antagonists kind of get short shrift in learning about screenwriting. And one thing that you do is you delineate the villain from the antagonist.
Yes.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because that was new for me. I had never thought about it that way.
Right, yeah. I think a lot of people think about quote-unquote villains. They're like the bad character. Who's the bad person in the character that's going against the protagonist? But they're not bad necessarily, right? And I think the whole Star Wars franchise that's been happening, right, when you really see it from the Darth Vader's perspective, that really, I think, really illustrates the whole thing, is that they're not necessarily the bad character in the movie. They're the protagonist, basically, their goal is to go against, they have their own goal and perspective, is that just that their need and their wants, their direction, just goes head on against the protagonist. And that's what the antagonist is. They're not a quote-unquote bad character, right? So you look at, you know, the classic romantic comedies, whoever the other character is that our protagonist trying to, you know, get the love from, they're the antagonist, but they're not bad, right? They just happens like, I want you, you don't want me right now, but by the end of the movie we will want each other. But that's what it is. And villains, obviously, then we take it to the whole thing. It's like sometimes like a villain is basically the evil in the, you know, the kind of the puppeteer from kind of more of a genre movie. I feel like that's when villains kind of come in, but they may not necessarily be the villain. So, you know, examples I think I brought up in the book, you know, like Minority Report, right? I think the Colin Farrell character pretty much is chasing, his job is basically to catch Tom Cruise because he is going to commit a crime in the future. So his job is to get him. But he's not a bad guy. He's doing his job. Just like Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive. He's not a bad guy, is he? He's the antagonist, though. He's the one stopping Harrison Ford every step of the way. However, both of those films have a villain, which is the twist of, like, who's the actual one behind it. And in The Fugitive, it's Harrison Ford's medical colleague who's kind of masterminded the whole thing. In the third act, that's when, you know, he killed off the villain, right? Mm-hmm. And same thing as The Minority Report. The founder of Precrime, who Tom Cruise worked for, was the person who had orchestrated the whole thing. So basically the villain is the bad guy, bad person, you know, in the story, but the antagonist is not necessarily the kind of the bad person. However, sometimes the antagonist could be the combo of the villain and the antagonist. So it just depends on what genre you're going for.
Now, you've taught screenwriting before. Yes. And read probably plenty of first draft screenplays.
Sure, yeah.
Are there any rookie mistakes that you see with antagonists and villains that people make and putting them against their protagonist?
Yeah, I think the rookie mistake is a lot of the antagonists, people, like you said, like we talked about, they don't want to be the bad perspective. So the antagonists are never really fully fleshed out, mm-hmm. right? And then they're not dramatic enough. They're not bad enough, if you will, right? And then they're not multidimensional. I think that's a rookie mistake because then they're not interesting, right? So the protagonist is so much more interesting and the antagonist basically not, as part, you know, it's not up to match or overpowering the protagonist, then there's no interest to follow that in from the beginning of the movie, you know.
Oh, sure. Because stronger antagonist will make a stronger protagonist, right?
Absolutely.
Because they have to really get their act together to battle.
Yeah. Right? And then the one thing, but how do you anchor that? You know, when people are creating antagonists, well, how do I create an antagonist? It's like, because you create a protagonist first, then I just need someone to go against that person, but that's kind of the wrong way to think about it. Not wrong way, but kind of like it's too abstract way of thinking about it. How do I create an antagonist? But what I like to do is like, and then as a starting point for people, you know, kind of crafting a hard time or challenging time, crafting the antagonist, a good way that like my process is this. Whoever my protagonist is, I kind of think the antagonist is the warped version of mm-hmm. the protagonist. Just the same person, but just a very warped version of it. And so basically all the motivations of the antagonist is very justified in that antagonist's mind.
So like a shadow of the protagonist.
Yes, absolutely. But shadow, but a very twisted, you know, shadow of it. Yeah, yeah.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that before. Yeah. So they almost are the same, two sides of the same coin.
Absolutely. Basically. And the classic thing is obviously, hey, I'm not a super big Star Wars fan. I mean, obviously I enjoyed it if I saw a couple of them. But it's really the classic example, right?
Yeah.
You look at Luke Skywalker, Darth Vader, both Jedis.
Mm.
They're father and son. One's in the dark side, you know? One is... And then, you know, I always put like, what's a sympathetic kind of point of view is that, you know, the father, Darth Vader, he can't go back to the regular... I mean, he's in the dark side. But he wants to be with his son. You know, how sympathetic is that? He just wants to reunite with his son. See, that's a sympathetic kind of viewpoint of it. Obviously, he's doing bad things, quote unquote, but that's sympathetic. So I kind of always start for that. Like, how do you warp that character and just really put the extreme of that and then go from there?
Yeah, that's great. It's great advice and a great way of thinking about it. Let's talk about filmmaking in China.
Yes.
And now, as you mentioned earlier, kind of global filmmaking.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Netflix in China?
No, they're not allowed to be in China.
Does China have their own version of Netflix?
Yes, they have So basically, China has a company called iQIYI. I-Q-I-I-Q-I-Y-I. I think I spell it. It's basically Netflix China. So basically, they license a lot of content. So a lot of Hollywood movies that people in China watch, the library of film titles are streamed on iQIYI. And also do the original content, but not as aggressive and high budget as Netflix is. So yeah, so Netflix is not in China, but there, as you know, Netflix basically they're moving towards doing a lot of not moving towards. They are doing local productions in different countries.
Mm.
So even though they can't get into China, they are doing a lot of Mandarin language productions that would be set in Taiwan, you know, Hong Kong. Or Singapore and whatnot, but that Taiwan for sure there. So Greater China. So at least you have a Mandarin language you know, piece that ultimately that could be accessible by, you know, the world, right? When Chinese is the largest population, Han Chinese, in the world. So,
right.
So there's going to be some population. So maybe if it's a good enough content, they could sell it to iQIYI or just even distribute to all the Chinese speakers, right? Because the Netflix is global, you can watch that. So this is really, I think it's a great tactic they're doing.
Sure. I was so fascinated to find out how China just loved Downton Abbey.
Like, yes, yes.
They created like a whole village.
Yeah, they do that. They even created a Titanic, like a version of Titanic. For sure. And they do the full out version.
Yeah. That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
So you talk a lot about the success of like Crazy Rich Asians.
Yes.
Such a great movie.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Awkwafina is just this breakout star, I think. If I want to write a project and I don't speak Chinese.
Yes.
Is it possible to write something that I think could work for both Hollywood and China?
Yeah, I just think it's understanding. Absolutely, absolutely. And look, a lot of American writers, a lot of American producers, and you know, whether from veterans to, you know, beginners and whatnot, want to find a way to do co-productions because it is a China and U.S. are the two biggest film markets in the world, right? And then next to the projected China will be the biggest film market in the world. So it only makes sense to find those kind of common grounds. So I think the thing is to keep in mind is if you are doing something, I think one of the mistakes, like most writers go into thinking of China, the thinking back in the 90s, of Hong Kong, which is very different than China. I think the distinction, and again, I'm sure a lot of the listeners would know the difference, but what we kind of, a lot of times, American writers or, you know, people who, you know, most, I don't know, generalize, but they would kind of go back to the whole Hong Kong, Jackie Chan, those kind of Chinese movies, or, you know, the Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon, Night in the March, or those are really kind of dated kind of perspectives. You have to really think what modern China is, and modern China is very different than what Hong Kong, you know, all those films that Chinese film that we see, those martial arts movies, not really a martial arts heavy kind of cinema in modern China. So modern China is very reflective, just like any movies like in America, right? And modern is not like, it's almost like, I'm going to do a bunch of Westerns, you know, day in, day out, right? It's not that. That's a very dated thing, isn't it? You know what? American cinema, it's a John Wayne. So it's almost like you want to do John Wayne movies in China, you know, going to it. And I think the other kind of things to be mindful of, I think what a lot of folks are taking old scripts and that's set in America and let's just flip it, like instead of Chicago, just make it Beijing, you know?
Right.
That's a common mistake. I think you have to be really organically understand like what it is. And I think the biggest mistake is, not biggest mistake, the biggest kind of like the first trial and error, again, you know, you would think the way, it's like, you think that, the typical things I hear all the time, people go, what do you think of this story? When they work in China. An American goes to China, fill in the blank, and meets law, whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. Be great for an American audience, maybe, or a Western audience, because through that character's perspective. But why would, quote unquote, the Chinese audience be interested in watching about their country from a foreigner's perspective? Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
If it's all, it's like finding jokes and being funny and like fish out of water, but you're in, we're the water, you know, while we entertained by this. But you just think, oh no, but it's in China, we're shooting in China, we're being like, but that, I think that's kind of, I think you have to really, I'm not saying you can't have an American character and a Chinese character working together to per se, right? You know,
right.
But it has to be a very well thought out, organic way of entering. And obviously there hasn't been that many examples of a successful co-production. People are trying. It is not the easiest thing to kind of crack, but it is doable. It is possible. And I think we start from the script level, and I think that will pave a really fascinating future, and it will create a lot more connectivity, I think, between the two film markets and the two audiences, and that's what we want.
Yeah. There's a recent film called The Farewell.
Yes, yes.
Lulu Wang.
Yeah, it's opening this weekend, yeah.
Lulu Wang was interviewed the other day and on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and she said that when she pitched the film, the studios would always ask her, well, is this a Chinese movie
mm-hmm.
or an American movie?
Right.
And she didn't reveal how she would answer that question.
Right.
So what does that mean, in a Chinese film versus an American film?
Yeah, well, definitely, because I think what happens is, I'm sure, I mean, when she's pitching, I don't know what her circumstance was, but a lot of folks have been like, well, you know, co-production is so challenging, so difficult. You can't really satisfy both at the same time. So pick your audience. So that's probably what they meant by that question. It's like, right. Is this for a Chinese audience? Is this for an American audience, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that from a kind of the producing point of view, from the studio point of view, from kind of, you know, this marketing point of view, you want to say, well, who are we marketing this to? But right. I don't know. From the trailer I've seen, I can't wait to see the movie.
Yeah.
It's a human story. It's just, why do we need to pick that? Especially when it's such a global stream, you know, and not that this movie's going to be streaming, but right. In terms of the world's going to be have a we're in a savvy. It's so easy to travel. We see different stories. Maybe because of Netflix, you see different, you know, movies from different, all around the countries, from all around the world. So I don't think we need to pick as much, I feel, you know, in that respect. And I want to go back to Ang Lee, which is my hero.
Ang Lee.
So I'm not sure if you've seen his whole body of work, his Chinese language, even before Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And one of his breakout movie and his first Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film was a movie called The Wedding Banquet. Which is, again, I haven't seen A Farewell yet, but I imagine it's kind of like that mix of culture, right? Except we're in New York, but it is like half English, half Chinese. Mm-hmm. But that movie was actually made as a Taiwanese movie, just shot in New York. Just thought maybe it would just be for the Taiwan audience. He's got a grant, he made that movie. But it went on, it was distributed by Samuel Golden Films. It was made for less than $1 million. It was back in 1993, okay? Back then when LGBT, you know, when it's a quote-unquote gay character film, it's a gay, you know, going to a very niche thing. It made almost $30 million in that year. And this is before internet. This is traditional distribution, you know, worldwide. And then it resonated with people, you know? It wasn't just that, quote-unquote, the LGBT community that went to see the movie. It was everyone went to see the movie. And I think that kind of parlays the success of when we saw Brokeback Mountain. I mean, that movie went to gross. Again, definitely not just the, you know, people of that community, you know, the characters community went to see the movie. It was everyone because it was a universal movie. And I think he just did that so well. So he wasn't picking. It's almost like asking, you know, is this for a gay audience or is this for a straight audience? You know, that becomes that question, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So for me, I'm not sure how she answered, but for me, like, I prefer not to pick that audience, you
sure.
know, right? You know,
sure, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was just curious because she seemed, and I'm just projecting this, a little annoyed that she
sure.
was asked that question over and over.
Right.
So I was just trying to kind of get a perspective on...
Yeah, but I understand why they would ask that question. If I was a financier, I want to know where am I putting my attention on. But I think we're at this moment in time with there's so many different various platforms and so much... And audiences, I feel... Now it's about getting more specific than being more general. You know, I remember when I started out, you know, my feel was like I have to be general in order to be universal. But I feel now it's being specific. That's how you become universal, if that makes sense, you know. Universal feelings, universal like human emotions, right? And then The Farewell Film is about family. It's about, right? It's about all that history of it. But having a very specific point of view. And I think that's what's going to stand out, too, I think. You know, and that's going to be reflective of you as a storyteller. And I feel like the more specific you can be, the better it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's really good advice. I want to talk a little bit about the tropes of Chinese films, because as an American who's white, like, I just don't... I know very little about, you know, Chinese culture and... I mean, I love shows like, you know, Fresh Off the Boat.
Right, yeah.
You know, so you talk in the book about, a little bit about, I guess, censorship.
Yes,
and things you can talk about in movies and things you can't. And one of the things that that isn't acceptable is to do, like, supernatural ghost stories.
Right.
It's fascinating to me. Because there's a whole genre of that here in America. So,
right.
So those movies don't go to China?
No. You can have supernatural. I mean, there's always exceptions. And it's more specifically Chinese movies not to have supernatural elements. And here's the thing. One thing to keep in mind, like censorship, and I do talk about, I mean, censorship, what it is, but also one thing to kind of understand from this perspective is that film for the Chinese culture is it's a cultural enterprise. It's not an entertainment enterprise.
Mm.
It's a cultural enterprise. It's not, hey, it's fun. It's make believe. It's cultural. So what does that mean? That means the values projected has to be reflective of the high end of that culture, if you will. So that's why I think, quote unquote, these censorship things that they would not like want to portray is that you don't want to, you know, which is very understandable, right? You know, so I think the ghost part of it is that they don't want. Chinese like to watch movies that are very grounded, if you will. So, for example, Star Wars didn't do exponentially well in China, right? Okay, because it's very, what do you call it, sci-fi opera? What do you call it, Star Wars?
Space opera.
Space opera, sci-fi opera, space opera. But they love The Martian, right? So it is that kind of that groundedness of it. So supernatural horror. So there are horror movies. There are supernatural movies in China. However, at the end, it has to be either a dream or psychological imagination, which is, I don't know. I mean, you look at Shining, that's a psychological thing, right? I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's one thing, yeah.
So, yeah, but you probably can't do Sixth Sense. You know, that's probably a big no, right? But you could do The Shining. So it's not like I'm so limited. So people go like, oh, all these restrictions, I'm just not... There's so many genres, so many stories you can tell. You don't have to always the horror, you know, kind of certain movies, you know, to go into.
Now, this might be a ridiculous question, but is the ghost thing because they're communists and they don't believe that there's an afterlife? Is that
right? No, I don't think it's that. Okay. I just think it's like they don't want folks to feel, to have fear, like, oh my gosh, it's like a real something out of control, you know? Yeah, yeah. So I don't think it has to do with the political stuff. It's more like they don't want, you know, again, in China's population of 1.4 billion people, right? And they are major cities, they're very sophisticated cities, very modern, obviously, huge economy, right? But they just don't want folks to kind of be fearful of, you know, kind of, right? Like, what if you start believing in it? You know, how many times have people read ghost stories, kind of like, maybe they are ghost stories, or watch certain things that kind of start, so it's just more of a precaution. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just thinking of The Exorcist, and it's like, yeah, maybe...
No, that would not work. Yeah, that's that wouldn't work. Yeah.
And then you say... there's no rating system in China.
Right.
So they have to be, the movies all have to be appropriate for a general
audience. For a general audience. That means no ultra violence. You can't have Scarface, you know. But you could have action, you know, right? So there's like, maybe not Rambo 1. Rambo 1 is kind of realistic action. But, you know, we got to Rambo 3. You know, I'm not sure if you've seen Rambo 3. Rambo 3 is more like, it's almost like this action, but yeah, it's like a G.I. Joe-ish kind of a feel. You could have that. I mean, there's guns or shooting. There's one of the top grossing movies. The top grossing movie in China is a movie called Wolf Warrior 2. Mm-hmm. Made $800 million in China alone. That's how... amazing it is, right? How big it is. But that's pretty much like a very Chinese-esque kind of a Rambo kind of a thing to it. So there's like gunplay and action, but it's very G.I. Joe-ish. It's not like gory. So you can have gory and no ultra sexuality. You know, again, it's because of the rating system, right? Would you want to take a 8-year-old to watch Basic Instinct? No, right? So it's very that. And then that's why those restrictions are in place.
And... it's funny because you also say time travel storylines are discouraged.
Yes.
Well, between you and me, I kind of have like this schizophrenic relationship to time travel. Like, I can't stand it.
Right.
In
right.
sci-fi.
In sci-fi.
Because
okay.
I cannot suspend my disbelief.
Yeah.
But I am writing a comedy that's sort of in the vein of Hot Tub Time Machine.
There you go. So you are.
So
time travel.
I
yeah.
am writing a time travel yeah. movie, but it's a comedy.
Yes.
So like because it's a comedy, like I'm okay with that.
Yes. Yes.
But why is it discouraged in China?
And again, these rules are kind of, they come up when certain things come up. It's like, it's not like they have a master rule list. It's basically as things seem to get out of control and they felt the impact. So I think a few years ago, there were a bunch of TV series, I believe, basically about modern Chinese men going back to like some dynasty and romancing the women there. And then, but again, this goes back to the whole concept of culture. You don't want to mess up culture. You don't want to change history, right? But that's changing history. That's you're denting history. So they want historical thing to maintain, you know, kind of severity. So again, but that also goes back to just want to be a grounded, you know, realistic world, not like a fantasy. So that's why sci-fi, right now, the sci-fi genre is very popular in China. There's one movie called The Wandering Earth, which, so I think for folks who want to see like the most contemporary, you know, Netflix is, they have it. They have a few Chinese movies, and the one they just picked up, the recent hit, I think it made about almost $700 million. Mm-hmm. And you can watch it on Netflix. You get an idea of like what that movie is called, The Wandering Earth.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's written by a novelist who's a sci-fi novelist, and apparently Barack Obama likes his books. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so it's international, kind of a critically acclaimed around the world, so they made a movie out of it. But it's, again, the narrative storytelling is a little bit different. You know, it's a little bit different, but that may be a good first start to just kind of check out, and it's available on Netflix.
So if I'm interested in possibly writing something for the Chinese and American yeah. market, I should probably watch some of these movies.
Yeah, I think it's very important. And for the listeners, you know, if you're in certain cities where there's a concentration of Chinese population, where like, you know, recent immigrants or students and whatnot, a lot of the AMC theaters, their show day and day Chinese films.
Really?
That's modern. So you don't have to go to Beijing and watch with audience. But I think it's important if you're really serious about it and just be open-minded. And you can approach Chinese more. I mean, obviously, there's going to be opportunities because they want writers. You know, they want writers and storytellers to help tell the Chinese stories. And it's very important to kind of watch it on the big screen with a Chinese audience to really understand. Mm. Like where the laugh points are, and it's subtitled and everything, so it's good clear quality, you know, and everything. So I think it's a great first step. So if you're in Los Angeles, in Monterey Park, in San Gabriel Valley, there's a, I'll tell you, it's called Atlantic Times Square Plaza, and there's an AMC there, and they play huge loads of, usually three screens are showing Chinese, current Chinese films. Yeah, and you can watch the trailers on there, you can just see like what it is, and just to understand, right? So, and I think what happens a lot too, a lot of screenwriters like, oh, I'm gonna write for China market because money or, you know, whatever it is. But I think you do have to go in with a good intention of understanding that and see, like, hey, is this a world I would like to get into? And how can we, you know, now understand what Chinese films are. And, you know, you understand what, quote-unquote, Hollywood movies are. And then what is a cool blend of that? You know, if you can do co-production stories, right? That's one way. Or maybe, you know, I don't think it, for me, even, you know, I'm Taiwanese. I'm also Chinese. I lived 2 years in Beijing, understanding, like, what the modern audience is, you know, so I have a good perspective on it. But in terms of, can I tell a pure 100% Chinese movie better than a local Chinese? Probably not as, well, I could, because I have the language ability. But if you're a pure, like, you've never been to China, you don't know the language, you'll probably have to kind of, like, work with a Chinese, local Chinese writer to piece it together. But to even do that, I think it's critical to understand and watch as many of the contemporary Chinese films as much as possible. But again, don't make the mistake of going back to the 1990s Hong Kong movies, because those are not the same. Absolutely right. Not the same. And really don't make those films as much anymore.
Do people hire you to work on their scripts?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, hire scripts. So I did a startup company a few years ago in China. And then worked as a producer, writer, producer. But I would basically, I break the story. I do like an original story by, and then I'll hire local Chinese writers who I've worked with. Actually, my former graduate students. In Taiwan, they speak Mandarin, fluently Mandarin, and write fluently, professional writers. And then we sell the project to studios. So I've done it in that respect. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Now I do more stuff like if it's American company, perhaps American producer, and mm-hmm. they're doing co-productions and whatnot, and then be involved with that. So doing assignments based off that.
That's so great. And yeah. What about female protagonists for China?
Yeah, great.
Yeah
more, okay. More so. More. I mean, if you not to go back to martial arts movies, then that's kind of Hong Kong. But you know, the Zhang Zi, all the great leads. If you look at all the great kind of Zhang Yimou movies, like the kind of the from Raise the Red Lantern to Live, all those kind of stuff. Those are the gold lead, you know, the actresses. They're the strong female, acting caliber. So yeah, absolutely. Now it's not just martial arts, you know, per se. The strong females, absolutely strong female characters are great.
Great. Well, your book, Crazy Screenwriting Secrets, How to Capture a Global Audience, is fantastic.
Thank you
for
so much.
Screenwriters of all levels.
Yes.
And it does have this, you know, bent towards the understanding and writing for the global market, which you don't get in any other screenwriting book that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is obviously it's very cutting edge. It's very new.
Yeah.
And I think it's the right book at the right time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Is there anything else you want to say about
No, I don't know when this goes on or is this, but July 25th, July 25th, I'll be doing a book event at The Grove, Barnes & Noble at The Grove in Hollywood, so locally in Los Angeles. I'd love to meet people there. And then, so it's July 25th, Thursday at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble at The Grove.
Great. Otherwise, we can get it on Amazon.
In any bookstore near you.
In any bookstore.
Yeah, any bookstore.
There aren't a lot of bookstores near me.
But. Yeah, right. But anything online. Yeah, Target, Walmart, okay. You order online. Online, any online venue is around the world. And it's also distributed in Europe as well, and as well Australia.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Thank you, Waco. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.